Welcome to the Sunday Long Read Podcast. My name is Don Van Natta. I'm the co-editor of the Sunday Long Read newsletter and co-host of this long dormant podcast that we are thrilled to be starting up again here today in this very special edition. We are promoting an SLR original story that we're very proud to be co-publishing with our friends at Pipe Wrench. It's a story about Mormonism, and we'll tell you a lot more about it. It's entitled Searching for Zarahemla. You can find the story on sundaylongread.com or on pipewrenchmag.com. The author of that story is Emily Kaplan, and she's my guest today. Emily's writing and photography have appeared in publications including The New York Times, The Atlantic, Harper's, and NPR. Emily is now writing a book about Protestant Christianity in America. And before becoming a journalist, she taught elementary school in Boston and the Western Highlands of Guatemala. Emily, welcome to the SLR podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. And I want to start with your life before becoming a journalist. I'm so intrigued by the fact that you taught elementary school in Boston and the Western Highlands of Guatemala. How did you transfer from that life as a school teacher to the life as a working journalist?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, starting when I was in probably high school and certainly in college, I knew that I had two main passions, which was working with small children and writing. And I knew that I was going to try to balance those two interests in my career. And I always thought that I would teach and that I would also write. And I love teaching and I miss it a lot, but it wasn't quite the right fit for me as a career. And a few years into teaching, I started writing about teaching and about education and, you know, systemic issues in education. My work started getting picked up and getting a lot of attention. And I started thinking, maybe this is what I should be doing full time. And so I started, for a few years, I taught part-time and also was reporting part-time. And then eventually I did make a switch into full-time writing and reporting. But I think, you know, I think that the two careers aren't actually as different as they might seem. I think a lot of what I learned as a teacher are completely applicable in my life as a journalist.
Give us one example of that.
You know, I think I taught kindergarten, first and second grade. And I think teaching those ages taught me to be able to talk to anyone. and to also to guide conversations, but to really take people where they are and being able to really be fully present in a conversation and make people really comfortable when I'm talking to them and give the genuine sense to people that I'm so interested in what they have to say, which is completely true. But I think kids don't pretend, you know, kids don't adhere to social norms, you know, and so if they don't want to be there, they make that very clear. And so I think it's actually very good training for a journalist because adults will sort of do what they think is polite, you know, and responding to people, but kids just don't do that.
That's so interesting to think of that as a toolbox, right, for interviewing skills, just that alone.
Absolutely.
And then obviously as a teacher, you need a lot of patience.
Yeah.
and you need a lot of empathy,
yeah,
both of which are very important tools for a journalist to have and that are
right
in great display in your story, which I love. Your story is about Mormonism specifically and humans' relationship with truth generally. So as a reporter and a writer, how did you work to try to weave those two things together?
So I think that's a great question. One thing I do want to clarify is the story is about a very particular phenomenon that's within mainstream Mormonism, but certainly not representative of all mainstream Mormons. I also do want to say that the prophet of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints does ask that people refer to the church with its full name. However, in my reporting, I have found that the vast majority of members of that church are just fine using the word Mormon and in fact prefer it. And so I've actually come to use the term Mormon at the direction of people I've spoken to in that community. But I also do want to acknowledge here that the official name is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And the members of that church are called Latter-day Saints.
Oh, I'm so glad you set the record straight on that.
No, I just want to make it clear for any listeners who are hearing that I understand that that's the official directive and that I've made the choice listening to people I have spoken to in the church who all say, no, please call us Mormons. So that's why I do that. The premise of this piece is that the Book of Mormon, which is a key scripture of the church, is a really complex narrative, a pretty complexly structured piece of literature that describes a lot of events that happened in ancient times. It describes when Jesus was resurrected after he was resurrected as described in the New Testament and visited the Americas. And it's not specific about where in the Americas he went. And then he interacted with civilizations that lived there. And then the Book of Mormon details many, many events that happened among these civilizations. And so there are groups of people in the church who are very fascinated with the idea of where exactly Jesus went and where these events took place. They do not see the book as in any way anything other than a literal history. And so they say, well, Jesus went to the Americas, and we have all of these hints about where these things took place. You know, something happened upriver of somewhere else between two mountains in sight of XY with this kind of crops, etc. And so they're able to sort of put together ideas of where those could be given those kind of geographic clues. And so there are people who have gone to various places in the Americas, in Central America. And also there are groups of people who think this happened in what's now the United States. There's others that think it happened in what's now Baja California. But I would say the largest group believe that it happened in Guatemala and southern Mexico, places where Mayan civilizations lived at the time and continue to live. And so I went on a tour of, it's called a Book of Mormon tour, that follows or traces the places that would adhere to what they believe that match descriptions in the Book of Mormon. So now some liberal Mormons think that this is offensive, ridiculous. They have these ideas. And so this does not speak to all Mormons, but certainly it speaks to people who follow these theories and who go on these trips.
Yeah, it's more the fundamentalist wing, right? Is that
well? It's not fundamental. Well, no.
Or it's not.
Right. Fundamentalist Mormonism is a whole separate thing, and I think mainstream Mormons are rightly sensitive about conflating the two. Fundamentalist Mormonism are small groups, like, you know, in the news we hear of people like Warren Jeffs who like run polygamous groups that are constantly in the news for all sorts of bad reasons. No. So those are what's called the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a separate phenomenon. These are not fundamentalists, but I think it would be accurate to say that these are more conservative. They're certainly theologically more conservative, a more conservative faction of the mainstream church, I think would be an accurate way to put it. My approach thinking about the human relationship with truth and Mormonism is, you know, I've been drawn to studying Mormonism from an academic journalistic perspective. Mormonism, I think, stands out among religions in that it is very literal and it is very clear about what it believes. There's very little room for the diversity of theological beliefs. I mean, that's not actually true among Mormons, but institutionally, leaders say what members should believe and what the truth is. And they have very specific ideas, for instance, about what happened before we were born and what will happen after we die, for instance. You know, this group that believes that Jesus visited the Americas and all these things happen have a very specific idea of what happened. And that narrative is incredibly important to their identity, to their, and especially to their theology. And so this story seemed like a really potent way to explore almost cognitive dissonance, or the potential for cognitive dissonance, or the question, I guess, what happens when your idea of truth confronts another group's idea of truth, and those two ideas conflict with each other?
The last line of your first section jumped off the page at me. You write this sentence: "There's always more than one way to tell a story," which of course is so true. And even in just in our conversation so far, we're touching a little bit on that theme. One of the things that struck me, Emily, about your piece is how conversational it is. It's very colloquial. It's very engaging. Why did you choose to write it this way?
That's a good question. I think, well, first I want to address what you're talking about, the more than one way to tell the story. I wanted to make that point very clearly in the piece, because that is really what the piece is about. You know, it's this tour is, I would say, rewriting the history of the civilizations that they're encountering. They're going up from Guatemala through Mexico, up through the Yucatan, and saying the things that we encounter, these archaeological finds that we encounter, the geographic phenomena that we encounter, are all evidence of the truth of the Book of Mormon. And of course, if you believe that the Book of Mormon is what they call true, which, and the idea of something being true is a very big deal in Mormonism, and I talk about that in the piece, then you're in many ways kind of imposing your own narrative with your own ends onto the history of the region and the history of the people. And so even just the very concept of this trip is about telling stories, right? Mm-hmm. And the value that you ascribe to different ways of telling the story. You know, I met many Mexicans who said, no, this is not evidence of the Book of Mormon in any way. In fact, that's very offensive. So I think that is the reason why I really wanted to bring out that theme in this piece. But in terms of the language, frankly, I just wanted to have fun. You know, in many ways, the trip was kind of ridiculous in a lot of ways, just in terms of just a lot of the experiences that I had. So in some ways, it was just I wanted the piece to be a travelogue in the tradition of travelogues, of road trip stories, of travel writing. But I also wanted, you know, made a very conscious decision to write it in a way that really reflected the idea that the way that we tell a story and to whom, and, you know, the register of the story, the vocabulary, the tone of the story all plays into that, to your expected readership, to who you're talking to. So I wanted that to really come out in the piece as well.
Yeah. And the other striking thing is that you were talking before about there doesn't appear to be much room for interpretation, right, among Mormons. It's very, for lack of a better term, it's kind of a strict here's the story, and it's strict. When I used the term fundamentalist before, I was almost thinking about my own upbringing as a Baptist. Fundamentalist Baptists believe in exactly what the scripture says. I think that's what I was, right, how I was referring to it.
Right.
And yet you encounter people that have all sorts of different views of Mormonism, right?
I wouldn't say that I encountered a great diversity of belief on the tour. The people who were on my trip had a pretty... They adhered pretty tightly to the sort of institutional line on theological questions and history. You know, there was a couple on the trip who said, we don't know that the theory that, you know, these events happen here is true. It's one possibility. It's compelling, but we don't know. But in terms of, you know, for other reporting that I've done, I've met people who have pretty radical interpretations of Mormon scripture and theology, ones that are extremely feminist, ones that are extremely queer, ones that do not take the Book of Mormon as a literal history. Those are pretty radical within the church, and certainly not something that any of the leaders support. None of that was represented among anyone that I met on this trip.
Okay. Was there a subject or scene in the story, Emily, that you're most excited for readers to encounter? What is it and why?
Someone that I was very interested, well, I was very excited when I met her and interested in her perspective, was this one woman named Maria Lopez, who was one of the first converts to Mormonism in Mexico. She converted in the 1950s. An indigenous woman who has the belief that she is the descendant of Lamanites, which were the civilization whose skin turned dark when they rejected the teachings of Jesus, you know, according to the Book of Mormon. So I was fascinated to find a woman who strongly identified with the church, who identifies as a deeply believing Mormon, who identified this way, because the Lamanites have been used rhetorically in the history of the church as a way to further a lot of really racist claims and ideas and actions. So it was fascinating to me to talk with someone who had reconciled for herself this phenomenon. And I also talked with her grandson, who's in his early 20s, who has a very interesting way also of talking about his ethnic identity as an indigenous Mexican and what that means for his identity as a Mormon. So I'm excited for readers to encounter them in the piece.
Emily, you write this toward the end of your piece, this paragraph. Storytelling is humanity's fervent, sometimes transcendent, sometimes lacking attempt to make meaning out of chaos. That's what all storytellers do. So I'm curious what you are hoping readers will take away from your storytelling in this piece.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that they have more material to reflect on that with, and to think about that idea more, that the idea that stories are our way of surviving in the world, of defining ourselves, of defining the world. They are our lives in many ways. The stories that we tell are the ways that we live. And I think, you know, the particular events that I talked about in this piece will probably be unfamiliar to most readers, and in some ways, perhaps a kind of extreme demonstration of this phenomenon. But I think, you know, extreme versions of something point to, you know, to other manifestations of phenomenon in our everyday, more familiar lives.
And you also write it about Joseph Smith and his famous book. You say the Book of Mormon is a remarkable work of literature. You write it's a mishmash of plots, of voices, of reference and registers. It is sloppy in places, profound in others. So you took on kind of a big challenge, I think, you know, as a journalist, I'm admiring what you did by taking on this subject and trying to tell the story through this tour in the way that you did. And I think you accomplished it. I think you pulled it off.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And the other thing, I appreciate that. And the other thing that I want to just mention is it will hopefully be apparent to people, but, you know, I started the piece in a kind of 19th century style that's alluding to the Book of Mormon's kind of tone and style. You know, I include phrases and you know, like the phrase, "And it came to pass," which any Mormon will recognize as the distinctive phrase in the Book of Mormon. You know, the piece itself I tried to structure in a way that's might be described as chiasmus, which is a literary device that is present in the Book of Mormon that a lot of, well, that many, some Mormons would describe as proof of its divinity, which I think is pretty extraordinary, that a literary device is proof of divine authorship. So I was really trying to have the piece speak to, you know, speak on a structural, formal, tonal level to what the Book of Mormon does. The piece also, you know, because it's Pipe Wrench publishing it is enabling it, which is fantastic and a perfect fit for this, is jumping off to other relevant texts that come up within the piece. So, you know, there are news clippings, there are quotes from academic pieces about Book of Mormon geography and archaeology. So the piece itself holistically is a mishmash of references, of tones. And so I really wanted to encapsulate that idea in the piece itself, which was, you know, a big thing to take on, and I hope I did a decent job. But I really wanted to have the reader aware of that on some level, you know, even if it just sort of in their emotional experience, reading the piece of really this kind of literary approach that is what makes the Book of Mormon what it is.
Yeah, it's a literary approach, but it's very accessible. You know, as I indicated earlier with my question just about your colloquial telling and your tone. And yeah, you echo those phrases from the Book of Mormon, and I found very effectively. And it is literary. The hyperlinks are fascinating. You can easily go down a wormhole when you click some of them with the references. And I did that as well. I mean, I love that. I'm a big fan of hyperlinks in long form. You know, you did it very effectively. I think this has been a great conversation, a great way to appeal to people to read the story that Emily wrote. It's been co-published, as I said, by Pipe Wrench and by us here at the Sunday Long Read. And Emily, thank you so much for being my guest today. It's been great talking to you. And I hope you write for us again in the future.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you so much for talking with me and for reading it. And of course, for co-publishing it.
Well, thank you so much. Emily Kaplan has been my guest today. Emily's writing and photography have appeared in publications including The New York Times, The Atlantic, Harper's, and NPR. Her wonderful piece, Searching for Zarahemla, is being co-published by our friends at Pipe Wrench, as well as all of us here at the Sunday Long Read newsletter. You can find Emily's story on sundaylongread.com or at pipewrenchmag.com. A few quick notes here, some credits before we sign off. I want to thank the folks at Pipe Wrench, especially editor Michelle Weber, who did a fantastic job on Emily's piece, and publisher Catherine Cusick. At the Sunday Long Read, my thanks go out to Peter Bailey Wells, our Sunday Long Read Originals editor, who did a phenomenal job as usual, our web editor, Annika Shrikanth, and producer, Alex Fuse. Writers interested in working with the Sunday Long Read can reach out to originals@sundaylongread.com. If you're not familiar with the Sunday Long Read newsletter, you can find us at www.sundaylongread.com. We curate the very best in long-form journalism every week. We drop in your inbox every Sunday morning at 7 a.m. Eastern. Members get an early edition of the Sunday Long Read at 6 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday. We like to call that our Bulldog Edition. This is the Sunday Long Read podcast. It's been long dormant now for a few years, but we're hoping to get it going again next year. Please let us know what kind of guests you'd like to have and hear here on the Sunday Long Read podcast. You can write to me or to Jacob Feldman, my co-pilot in the newsletter, at editors@sundaylongread.com. My name is Don Van Natta. It's been great to be with you today. Thanks again to Emily, and we'll see you again soon.